9, and I look forward to spending the morning with you.
I've been so out of touch. 90.1
KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
Today on the People's News, change happens, changing kids. Universities are slow to teach about January 6th. What is the public charge rule? And we are recording the show here at the Houston Marathon, which does its 50th running on Sunday, and will feature some interviews of runners and the directors of the event. All that and more on the People's News. We continue to feature music from A Tribe Called Red out of Ottawa, Canada. I'm Steve Gallington. This is the People's News. And the People's News starts now. At the end of December, the ExxonMobil refinery in Baytown caught fire, leaving 4 people injured from the blaze. This also brought back environmental and community concerns, as this refinery is one of the largest in the nation. Though the fire was in part of the plant being repaired, the refinery kept operating. This is not the first time that the ExxonMobil refinery in Baytown has had problems, who has had hundreds of workers laid off in contract negotiations. We talked to Corey Traoni, Senior Campaign Strategy Director with the Texas Campaign for the Environment.
Absolutely. I mean, this is really disappointing news to hear and really tracks with what we experience when chemical problems happen at facilities. Families and communities nearby, workers who are involved in the incident, rarely get a deep dive or follow-up into what they were exposed to, what the potential effects are, and what kind of health treatment they might need to seek. And oftentimes the reports are just reports from the company themselves who have a vested interest in downplaying the incident, downplaying the concerns. And we don't get a comprehensive report from any state agency or local agencies that might have a more of an interest in the public health.
What is the environmental community saying about it? Because I didn't really hear anything from the environmental community that it affects.
Well, first of all, I want to say, I mean, my heart goes out to the families of those workers that were affected and the families that were located nearby who were affected by the pollution and the chemical fires that destroyed their homes. Is absolutely a disaster, and it's something that we see time and again from these big petrochemical facilities in Texas. I mean, this company, ExxonMobil, has demonstrated just a clear lack of regard for their worker safety, for public safety, and it seems like they only care about profits. Last year, we saw in a nearby facility that Exxon owned in Beaumont that they locked out hundreds of unionized workers over a contract dispute and ongoing labor disputes, kept them out of the job and tried to quickly replace them with temporary laborers who had far less experience and certainly put those workers as well as the community nearby in danger. It seems like most actions that this company is doing is about shoring up more profits for shareholders and not about protecting the interests of the public.
And we also talk about, you know, you mentioned that the company gives their report on what happened. What about the organizations like OSHA and organizations, government organizations that's job is to protect the community?
Now, I haven't seen any report that Exxon has released on this, and I haven't seen any from other agencies. But one of the problems is that even if reports do get released by public agencies or state agencies, federal agencies, those reports are going to tail behind many, many weeks, if not months after the fact of the incident. And there's really not a lot of speed with which we're able to report back to communities what they need to do immediately, if there are concerns, if they need to, you know, head to a doctor or, you know, seek any kind of help or consultation about what they were exposed to. So I think what we can really do, especially in these communities that are fence lines to these big petrochemical facilities, is to first of all know what's going on in those facilities, have disaster plans, and know that if incidents do occur, and might as well say when incidents do occur with the rate that they are always happening, that we need to have disaster plans that quickly communicate to residents and give them an idea of what happened, what they can expect, what they ought to do. And I would certainly like to see a rapid response plan for compensating these residents who might not be able to just head to the doctor and have to pay out of pocket, you know, the expenses of of seeing a specialist or somebody that can treat them for some kind of chemical exposure.
The government has been very lax on enforcement and regulations. As a matter of fact, they want to cut back on the regulations they already have, and even said that there are less fines given out to these refinery companies after the fact.
Yep. This is just yet another example of that shows the wrong-headed approach that our governor is taking, that our state government is taking with respect to regulation. We need to rein these companies in when they are repeat violators, repeat offenders of the law, when they're putting people's health at risk, when workers are getting injured on site. This is just time and again we're seeing that our state government needs to react, and they need to be proactive about addressing our environmental laws, about stepping them up, about bringing these companies to justice, because quite honestly, if and when those fines do get assessed and levied on those companies, they're not enough to deter them from doing the wrong thing again.
To keep these companies in check, but also keep employment for the workers safe and employed. How do you bring the two together? Or can you?
I mean, it's a really good question. I think that there are aspects of the petrochemical industry that we need to be transitioning away from. I mean, we have a huge dependence on oil for transportation, for lighting, heating, cooling. Petrochemicals are really dominant in our society right now, and there's a big workforce that relies on that employment. There is certainly a need for us to transition away from toxic energy for most uses, and there are many ways that we can put the existing workers in those industries to work in cleaner industries. But then the kinds of petrochemicals that we're going to have to rely on during that transition, we need to be acting on them and enforcing the environmental laws. We need to be having consultations with union representatives that have an eye out for their workers, that are looking to improve safety in those facilities. I think in the short term, it's going to be a matter of tightening those regulations and protecting local communities and workers on those facilities. And then the longer term goal is going to be about helping those communities and workers transition off of these toxic facilities where they're no longer necessary and can easily be replaced by cleaner forms of energy that provide a healthy tax base, healthier jobs, and long-term careers for these communities for many decades to come.
You're listening to The People's News on Community Radio KPFT, Houston. The Bay and the Gulf Coast are also affected by these fires. As we talk to Kimber DeSalvo Anderson, Gulf Program Coordinator with the Turtle Island Restoration Network, she read a statement from her organization.
Yeah, absolutely. So we at Turtle Island Restoration Network are extremely concerned about the December 23rd fire at Baytown ExxonMobil plant and how little outreach has been conducted about the effects of naphthalene, a chemical typically used to plasticize resins and is considered an environmental contaminant and a carcinogenic agent, and what actually caused the fire. And our hearts go out to the affected and injured employees and community members from the unknown, potentially long-lasting impacts to human health. We ask that there is transparency on how the pollution has affected and still may be affecting the air and water quality in Baytown and the surrounding greater Houston and Galveston region. We believe that it is imperative that TCEQ needs to implement additional monitoring, stricter safety procedures for both workers and community members, and enhanced enforcement of those at petrochemical facilities like the ExxonMobil plant.
So, again, this is happening, and it won't pop up again till next time it happens. But you said it was no outreach to some of the environmental organizations about the concerns you might have.
Yeah, it seems like there has been little outreach, and I mean, we're extremely concerned about the local community as well. They're the ones on the front lines of pollution. So they're experiencing pollution day in, day out from the air pollutants that are left let out into the atmosphere just at a baseline. And it's unacceptable to have fires and explosions that could not only damage their health, but their homes too. It's my understanding that a couple homes were damaged in this fire, and that's not acceptable. We need to have stronger monitoring and clear safety procedures so that we could prevent a tragedy like this from happening again.
And the damage it might do the coastline too.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So Turtle Island Restoration Network, we're a nonprofit. We work internationally, but here in the Galveston, Houston area, we focus on protecting the coastline and beaches and the wildlife that calls that home. So we know that a lot of the chemicals that are used by petrochemical facilities do affect the health of the ecosystems. If they have carcinogenic effects for us, you can only imagine the effects to birds and sea turtles, fish, other wildlife. In Galveston, we have, there's a concern for the consumption of fish because of the high contaminant load of that fish. There's been research done that asks people to limit their consumption of fish, and these toxins are coming from these plants. So fires, like I said, there's baseline pollution happening just in their daily operation, but these fires and explosions just exacerbate the already high toxin load that not only the wildlife is experiencing, but our community as well.
All right. Tell people how to get in touch with your organization if they want to volunteer or donate.
Yeah, absolutely. So Turtle Island Restoration Network, we have a website at seaturtles.org. We also are on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And we are always accepting help and volunteers. There's an action page on the website that you could go to. And then we also are in the middle of opening doors to a new office in Galveston, and we're really excited about that. We hopefully will be able to open our doors soon.
You can reach Texas Campaign for the Environment at texasenvironment.org and Turtle Island Restoration Network at seaturtle.org. You're listening to the People's News on Community Radio KPFT, Houston. At 7:01 in the morning on Sunday, the 50th annual Houston Marathon will be run. With around 28,000 runners and with over $50 million in economic impact every year, the Houston Marathon is one of the things that puts Houston on the map. We spoke with the marathon director, Brant Koch.
All right, just give your name and title for the radio.
Hi, Brant Koch, and I am the president of the board of directors of the Houston Marathon Committee.
Oh, we took a break last year because of the pandemic, and we didn't take a break. We had a virtual event.
Yes.
But now we're back.
We are back. We are back with a vengeance. Yeah, it's really funny. I've been the president of the organization for, this is my 20th year as president of the organization. And I was the race director through 2020. I've now, and it really isn't a change at all other than title, but it's amazing how much, 18 years in a row and then 10 years before as a high-level volunteer, it's amazing how much you can forget in 1 year, all the details of staging an event this big and this complex.
And I remember when I was running the marathon, how much you were running also, as a volunteer, and how much has changed over the years.
Oh boy, yeah, I actually ran the event 1986 through 1992, and then got involved on the other side, and back then, I mean, we had maybe 5,000 runners total. We had no half marathon. We had no 5K even. I mean, it was one race. It was one event, one group of people running that one event. And then you flash forward 35 years, I guess, to or more, a little more, to today, and we have, you know, 28,000 people in the marathon and the half marathon, and then another 6,000 in the 5K on Saturday.
What's the fear of the pandemic, though, as far as, because Omicron is you know, catching on all over, you know?
We have been communicating with the Houston Health Department almost daily for the last 2 weeks. We actually prepared for an event in 2021. And what we were calling a COVID event, you know, we looked into having people only appear at the start line in stages. We went through all sorts of machinations, you know, to try to stall or prevent community spread. And we brought a lot of that into 2022. We're doing everything we can. The health department is completely behind us. They say you guys are doing it all just the way you should. Our medical director, Lars Thestrup, is actually kind of one of the top people in the health department. David Peirce is the director of the health department, and Lars reports directly to Dr. Peirce. Dr. Peirce was in on our calls over the last 2 weeks. We've done everything we can.
Was it any talk of postponing it again this year because of the rise in COVID cases?
Well, certainly we looked at it, and I mean, we asked, should we? And they said no. Time and time again, they said no.
With moving the schedule of the marathon to another date, was that something under consideration? I don't know if it's ever been done before. But
well, I mean, there have been years when we, for example, could not get the convention center on our normal weekend. Our normal weekend is always the weekend of Martin Luther King Day because it gives people an extra day to recover. And
you're listening to the People's News on Community Radio KPFT, Houston.
We have had to move. I think the year we hosted the U.S. Olympic Trials marathons, I think we moved to the last weekend in January. But But we did that too. We did that 2 years out. I mean, we were advised by the city, you're not going to have the convention center then. You need to push it back, or move it forward. And that's always hard to do with Christmas and New Year's right in front of us. So, you know, we look at it, but it's a true year long preparation. And you can't move it on a dime, if for no other reason that there are just so many other events scheduled in the city.
Well, also the runners that prepare, you know, you do the warm-up series. The warm-up series ends with the marathon. You know, you do
correct.
The 10 for Texas, then you do the Cinco Ranch run.
We do
and
that.
And you do the 30K.
Half marathon, the 25K, right. The 30K. You know, this year the 30K did not happen. The organizer there had decided to step back, and then there were some issues after that decision. We thought we had somebody that might step up, but it just I probably shouldn't discuss that thing.
No, I mean, it's, you know, I know it's tough being a director.
Well, it was the gentleman who had directed that event for years and years passed away, and it was a respect thing. We didn't feel like we could carry on with that in light of his passing. It was very, very sad. Unexpected.
After all this the pandemic and everything else, you're still able to bring in top runners from all around the world.
I have been really excited about that. I was very worried. I mean, to be honest, our budget was hit pretty hard by COVID, not having an event last year, having to do it virtually only. You can imagine the numbers were way down. We kept our entire staff on full salary the entire time. And, you know, so it was difficult for us, and we weren't able to offer quite the financial considerations that we would like to for what are completely professional athletes. This is their living.
You have a Japanese runner.
Yes.
I'm very excited about that.
Second time we've had that. We had our women's winner in the half marathon in 2020 was from Japan. But, we did have a slightly limited budget this year, and I was tremendously gratified by the response we got. The professionals among them, I think everybody's eager to run. I mean, it's been a long time now, but the professionals in particular, I mean, as I said, this is their livelihood, and they really need to get out there. So.
You're listening to the People's News on Community Radio KPFT Houston. That's been really interesting. We're going to actually have an interview with Bernie Tretta.
Great.
In a little bit too about that. So that's good. Since Richard handed me the mic, I did have a question. So this, our show is going to air at 8 o'clock this evening. If somebody would like to come out and watch the marathon, what is your advice on that? Is there, you know, what's the website so they can go to it and figure out where to park and where's the best viewing for the run?
The website is www.houstonmarathon.com. Very easy.
There you go.
We do have an app. That is maybe the best way for somebody to get into this. It's set up for both iPhones and Android machines.
And so you can actually track runners. If you have somebody that's, you can actually track, I guess, bib numbers or whatever.
Yes, you can.
I had a good friend of mine who ran in the marathon in 2019, and actually she made the choice to move from the real event to the virtual event this year. I was kind of looking forward to running, to at least being here on the same day. But that was a very handy app. I downloaded that app, and I was able to figure out when she was going to be running by, so that was good.
Perfect, yes. Everything that was there then will be there again this year.
Fantastic.
So that's the best way to...
Yeah, HoustonMarathon.com, and you also can find out how to download the app there. And it really is impressive to see 28,000 people out running on a Sunday morning.
I would only say that you can go to the Android store, the iPhone store, and the app is there. Just search for Houston Marathon, and I'm sure it'll pop up.
One more question. I ask you this every year. When is the race going to relocate back to Third Ward or run through the Third Ward again?
Okay. Well, and unfortunately, I have to give you the same answer. The hard part is having non-grade railroad crossings. We don't want, because I'm here to tell you, every year I read a story somewhere nationally, a race has been stopped by a train crossing the course in the middle of the event. And so we have to look for ways to get across. And of course, Houston, I mean, Look at the city seal. It's got a train in it. Houston is a huge, huge rail center. And so there are tracks all over the place. And we have to figure out ways of getting into neighborhoods that do not involve those at-grade rail crossings. That's what did away with it in the first place. When we lost the Elysian Viaduct, we lost the way into the Heights and into the Third Ward from that. And there are two crossings. One is an underpass, and I think one is an overpass that could get us into the Heights, but they're very close together and they're fairly far out. And it just, as a course guy formerly, there's no way for me to figure out a way to make it happen. All right. But
hopefully
we do miss that part of the course for sure.
Hopefully in the future. Hey, thanks so much for coming on.
And my pleasure.
Being part of the People's News.
Thank you. This
is the community right here.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Over 200 of the athletes participating in the Houston Marathon this year are athletes with disabilities, part of the AWD program, which is headed by Bernie Tretta. Hi, this is Steve Gallington with the People's News, and I am sitting down with Bernie. Is it Tretta?
Yes.
Bernie Tretta is the director for the Athletes with Disabilities program for the Houston Marathon, and so special accommodation. So what does that mean? What does the AWD do for the Houston Marathon for athletes?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me.
Yeah,
The Athletes with Disabilities Program is a program that really focuses on inclusion of all athletes. And so we have multiple categories, including wheeler groups for wheelchairs, hand cycles, duo teams, and visually impaired, mobility impaired. And we have even had some intellectual impairment runners as well. So we do everything we can to give them the fantastic Houston experience that our other runners have.
So specifically, let's go into the wheelers. So I think my listeners all understand what a wheelchair is. So they roll in wheelchairs down the marathon. A hand cycle is what?
A hand cycle is a wheelchair with gears. And it is, if you can't lean forward or you have certain impairments in your upper body, then you can only use your arms in certain ways. And so it has sometimes, the old term for it was a hand crank. And so you turn with just your hands instead of using your full arms.
I see. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's kind of a, I've seen them, and it's like a tricycle arrangement, like a recumbent bicycle.
Yes.
And sometimes some of these athletes are laid down really, really low, which if you're a cyclist, you know that's good for aerodynamics, makes you go faster. And then they just, you know, it's kind of push up and like a
So it's almost like pedaling with your arms. And
yeah.
Depending on your impairment, you can lay down if you have no functioning abs or back muscles. And
right.
So you can lay down very low and the gears be above you. Or if you are a certain type of amputee, then you're on a bike where the crank is below you and you kind of sit above it and push. So.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. And then what is – so wheelchairs, are these – like fancy kind of racing wheelchairs, or do they?
Yes. They're all fancy racing wheelchairs. And they're called push rim, and you'll often see they have really specific gloves that have like rubber padding on them, so that they can grip those wheels very tightly and then stop themselves when they need to.
Because there are no brakes. No brakes on one of those.
No, you want to go fast.
You want to go fast, and the wheels are canted.
Yes,
out so that you get a wider stance, a little bit more stable.
Mm-hmm, and they can make turns a little easier.
And then what is a wheelchair duo?
A wheelchair duo is when there is somebody that is in a wheelchair that is being pushed. And these are very specific wheelchairs. It's not like what grandma's in. Mm-hmm. And these are racing type wheelchairs, but they often have bigger area to sit in. And so it's usually for children or adults with something like cerebral palsy that can't move at all. And then somebody pushes them. And so imagine like a very big, heavy racing stroller. And so that's what duo team is.
How neat. I actually have some statistics on that. And I just want to let everybody know that this year there are 12 wheelchair duos in the marathon, which is the largest number yet for the Houston Marathon.
Yep.
And then 12 wheelchairs, the kind of the racing wheelchairs, and 19 hand cycles. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty exciting. And then in addition to that, there's 29 visually impaired and 10 mobility impaired athletes. Mm-hmm. And I know that the wheelers actually start off 10 minutes before the elite runners start, so like at 6:50 in the morning on Sunday morning.
Yep, right? They start 11 minutes because the race starts at 7:01.
You're listening to the People's News on Community Radio, KPFT, Houston.
So they start 11 minutes ahead because they're very fast. And even the people that aren't very fast, if they get tangled with the runners, it's dangerous for both the wheelchair and the runner. You can imagine what it would feel like to get hit by a wheelchair, and it would not be fun. So they take off ahead of everybody.
And the hand cycles are kind of low to the ground. They're hard for runners to see sometimes.
Yes,
too.
And so they every one of our wheelchair duos and hand cycles are given bicycle guides or some sort of guides depending on their speed for visibility and safety. And of course, all of our regular runners, the mobility impaired runners and the visually impaired runners, are provided guides
as
well.
Guides that run along with them.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I got involved with the marathon this year. I mean, every year I like to come out, and we do stories about that. But I'm an avid cyclist, as people listen to the program very much, they hear that. And so I get a chance to be a guide for one of the hand cyclists this Sunday. So I'm very excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. So how long has Houston been doing accommodations for those with disabilities?
So there's never been an official program prior to when I started. So I started it 8 years ago. This is our eighth year of the AWD program. And before that, occasionally a wheelchair or two would sign up. And many, many years ago, they had, you know, maybe 10 But by far, this is the biggest program, and it is now an actual running program and organization, not just, you know, somebody with a wheelchair that signs up. And so we've been doing it for 8 years now.
And I do happen to know, you know, through my doing workouts with the Achilles group, I did meet Wendy Larson.
Mm-hmm. Larson.
Larson. Wendy Larson is a hand cyclist. She won the Boston Marathon in the hand cyclist division. Mm-hmm. And according to the numbers that I've seen, she has the she's got the fastest pace of any of the hand cyclists that are in the ride
at
on
least
Sunday.
Of the females.
Yes,
but unfortunately, Wendy can't participate on Sunday anymore.
Oh, really? She can't? Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's a bummer, but yeah, there's always next year.
Yeah, no,
she's very fast.
She's very fast, and you know, it was fascinating because I got to participate with her in a workout where she was a recovery workout for her, so she was not going super fast. So we got a chance to talk, you know, as you're riding along. And I said, well, it's really interesting, you know, how has the coaches have been really training her?
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest part for her has been aerodynamics. They taught her to, you know, position her feet and her toes so that her toes are pointing in. And I said, that makes enough of a difference. And she said, you know, my experience in the Boston Marathon was, what they taught me, part of the coaching was, when you're going downhill, don't pedal, you know, don't crank.
Mm-hmm.
Just let the aerodynamics carry you down the hill and then use that as recovery. And then when you go up the next hill, then you've got some juice for it. And she said, well, what happened is the men would pass her going down the hill, pumping away, and then she passed them going up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up doing a, you know, really a good time. She had a good time. And then she talked, you know, about her next upgrade is she's going to be buying luge boots, which is the boots that luge, you know, athletes wear that are really aerodynamic. And she says, unfortunately, you can't get them here in the U.S., but you got to go to Germany to get them. And they're like $400 a pair. It's like, wow, this is really an expensive prospect, you know, doing that. Well, I'm sorry to hear that she's not able to compete this year, but I'm very much looking forward to it. So if somebody listening to this is like, oh, you know, I never even thought I could compete in a marathon with my disability,
mm-hmm.
What would be a good way for them to get started into it?
Well, there are a number of nonprofits that operate in this space. We have four specifically. But I would say reach out to Achilles International. Achilles International is a nonprofit that accepts all types of disabilities, whether it's intellectual or developmental or something, you know, blind or an amputee. Catapult is physical disabilities.
Okay.
ICANN is blind people only, or blind or visually impaired.
Sure.
And then My Team Triumph, or Wings Over Texas, is for duo groups.
Okay.
And so I would say if you feel like you fit into one of those groups, and even if you don't, reach out to them. Achilles International is the largest of all of the groups. It is an international organization, and it does accept any type of disability.
You're listening to the People's News on Community Radio, KPFT, Houston.
So that would possibly be your best first start. You know, a marathon is a very long way to go. So
right, it's a goal. It's a goal.
Yeah,
it takes
a
long-term
goal,
sure.
Right. But that doesn't mean that you can't get out and walk, or, you know, walk for 15 minutes with the group on weekends.
Yeah, and one of the suggestions I have, Achilles International, I've gotten involved with them. They do workouts every Saturday. And also how I got introduced to Achilles is one of the friends of the show that we've had on quite a bit is Hannah Walker, who does the adaptive sports at the Metropolitan Multi-Service Center on West Gray. And I got involved with her leading a group of hand cyclists on a bicycle ride every week. And they've got a whole set, a dozen or so hand cycles. And there's people like me who can help you learn how to do it as well. And so for whatever activity, whether that's wheelchair or basketball or rugby or anything like that, that's also a good place to start. So, you know, if you're thinking about it, and they also have the equipment for you to try out before you have to make the investment, because these hand cycles are at least, well, God, they're at least $3,000 and up for there to get a good hand cycle. So let's see. You've been involved in this, and before were you doing this? I heard that you were also involved with Achilles a while back too.
So I guess about 9 years ago, I started the Houston chapter of Achilles International.
So you started it, okay?
Yeah.
And what gives you this passion for, you know, working with people with disabilities?
Well, my mother is disabled,
okay.
And so that's how it first. Well, I actually kind of fell into it. Actually,
mm-hmm.
I had no intentions of starting a nonprofit. That was the furthest thing on my radar, and
sure.
I kind of stumbled into it, and then when I said I wasn't going to do it and I told my mother about it, she was pretty offended. So, you know,
well, you know,
what mom
mothers,
says goes.
Mothers of all kinds, you know, guilt trip is like, that's the ninja level on doing the guilt trip. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, don't mind me. You mm-hmm. know, it's like, all right, great, great. Okay, well, you know, this show is actually going to be airing tonight, mm-hmm. Friday night. We're talking Friday during the day. And so people will be able to hear, if they're interested in like watching the marathon, what do they need to do?
Oh, they need to go out and cheer. It is a fantastic day. Dress warm because yeah. it will be cold and possibly windy. But if you go to HoustonMarathon.com, you can find the route and all of the street closures and even
and
a
so
list of
where
the
you
best
need to park
place,
and
yeah.
that type of thing.
And even the best places to cheer.
To view, yeah.
So, it is a great resource. So if you're an app kind of person, you can download the app.
Yes,
too.
And the app is wonderful. I actually had a good friend of mine who ran in 2019, and I was able to keep track of where the bib number was, where she was all through the, you know, so I knew mm-hmm. when to look up and when to look for her. And kind of like 2019, it was pretty cold 2019. It may be a little bit chilly on Sunday. And, you know, what you find out is that the athlete doesn't look, at the end of the race, they don't look the same as they did when they started because they've got all these layers on and they just kind of throw them out, you know, as they warm up. So, well, Bernie, thank you so much for spending a little time with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, good luck with, I know that you're very, very busy. So thanks for taking some time out of your day and hope it turns out as great as it's going so far and everybody has a good experience.
You're listening to the People's News on Community Radio, KPFT, Houston. And we also spoke with Frank Laura, a top-seeded marathon athlete who is hoping to qualify for the Olympics this year.
See who you are and what you're going to do tomorrow. Not tomorrow, on Sunday.
I'm Frank Laura, and I'm going to run the Houston Marathon on Sunday.
All right. And we can't call you local. Can we still call you a local runner?
I call myself a local runner. I mean, Houston's home, and I'm very excited to be here and be a part of this.
This is going to be an amazing race. You're running in front of your family and friends. How's that going to be? Is it going to feel nervous at all?
I mean, as nervous as you can be, really. And it's going to be really cool to have their support kind of scattered throughout the course. My mom and dad will be like driving around and kind of picking me off at every point of the course they can. And yeah.
Have you ran this race before?
I've run the half before 2 years ago, and it was really cool to have like friends, like they were around like the 6 mile mark, and with the American pack that I was in, I saw them. They were like, "Oh, Frank!" And then I like turned to one of the guys running next to me, like, "Put some. Those are my friends over there."
What'd they say?
He just kind of shook his head at me, but it was really nice, like a really cool, exciting feeling to have that. And like, it'll be, I think, in the marathon, it's definitely a lot more important to have that kind of. It'll play a bigger role because you're out there for a while.
Does it bring any pressure on you?
What do you mean? To perform? You mean?
Yeah, to perform, because you got so much, it's like added pressure when you got your friends and family.
I'll say it's more of a supporting feeling. Yeah, it'll be, I feel like I can run for them and just do what I can do what I've been training for, and Sunday will be kind of a celebration of my training, and like, I just get to show off what I can do for them, and they can cheer me on and give me all the best wishes, and it'll be really cool to see them on the course.
As a kid, how did you get involved with running?
I went to John Paul II Catholic School, elementary school, and the crush I had in elementary school joined the track team. I saw her go and like sign up, and I said, "I'm gonna join the track team. let's join the track team." I didn't really know what I was doing, and then like a couple years of doing it, I was like, "I'm pretty good at running. This is awesome. This is awesome." And you just kept like kind of breaking barriers, getting down, running a sub 5 minute mile, and like. Kind of kept escalating from there, and like now that's kind of like the pace I'll be looking to run on for 26, which is wild to think about. How that was kind of like I can only do that for 1 mile before.
And in this time you're running against some top elite guys, and how awesome is that? And that's just gonna make you even a faster runner.
Yeah, I mean I like to think that if as the more competitive the field is, the more everyone will rise to that kind of challenge. And the field for the Houston Marathon is really, really good. And I'm really excited that I can compete against them and have this opportunity, because I can't imagine a better setup for me to try to go run fast and run a really competitive race.
We can talk about Olympics also, and you being an Olympic hopeful.
Yeah, I mean...
Are you on track for that?
So the marathon team for the, I guess, 2022 World Championships has already been chosen, but... yeah, I mean, for 2024, I think the Olympic marathon is kind of the goal I want to qualify for and compete for the U.S. team. But yeah.
What other things do you have to work on to get to that level?
I mean, we'll run the marathon and then find out. Gotta run one. Check it off.
Okay. And these guys now, like we talked about before, they're running like sub 5 minute miles, you know, like mid course, you know, and like it's like nothing. And back to a five. How weird is that for you? You know.
Yeah, I mean, I've run, I think, competitive in the half marathon. I've run like pretty competitive to what these guys have run. So like, I know I haven't had the marathon to back that up just yet, but I feel like I'm in kind of the same shape to be able to go out and run. I mean, like, I kind of, coach gave me some pace ranges of like from 4:53-ish to like 5:02 are kind of like the range he wants me in. But, we'll see how that, I mean, it's hard to like try to hit a pace when like you don't know what the weather's going to be like. So it's, I don't know. I go into it thinking I'll compete for 20 miles and then, or just stay in it for 20 miles and the last 10K, just compete and race everyone you can.
Okay, that's great. That's great. And we talked about the high altitude training. I mean, that's something that's important that people sometimes look over. But you're in Colorado and you're doing the high altitude training. How much of an effect does that have on you?
It's definitely has an effect. I mean, when I running in Colorado, I think my easy runs are mostly like 7:15, 7:30 pace, and like you come down here and like the same like feeling feels like 6:40, 6:30. So it's like definitely like a big change in pace, and like I pretty much race only at sea level, so like doing workouts at altitude, if it's going poorly, if it feels really really hard, you're like, this is the pace I can run for the race. Why can't I do this out here? And you're like, oh wait a second, it's there's less oxygen up here. I forgot about that. So it's always nice to like, even if you maybe like running slower in workouts, it's like this isn't the pace that you're trying. This pace will be a lot easier when you're racing. So I'm really looking forward to having that feeling.
All right, cool. Hey, you got any questions, Steve?
Just a reminder. So you grew up here in Houston, out near, out on the west side of town, right?
Yes.
You're going to have a lot of, friends and family out there on the course, like you did on the half marathon before?
Yeah. My mom and dad will kind of be driving around the course and trying to reach me at all the different places they can. And, it'll be really cool to look over and just see them cheering me on, and looking forward to seeing them again.
So did your crush keep on running? That was the other question.
She did not.
No, okay.
No. But I did fall in love with running because of her.
Okay, well, it's a good story. That's a good story. That's great. So just want to say thanks. Thanks for being on the show, and best of luck for Sunday.
Of course. Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be in Houston.
All right, cool. And we hope the best. We'll be looking for you, too. We're hoping you come across the finish line in first.
Me too.
You're listening to the People's News on Community Radio KPFT, Houston. Change Happens, one of the largest Black-founded and Black-led nonprofits in the greater Gulf Coast region, has been working with vulnerable and disadvantaged populations since 1989. The mission of Change Happens is to empower people to help themselves. And since its inception, Change Happens has been providing programs and services through a holistic approach with the belief there is no such thing as a single-issue struggle, because we do not live single-issue lives. The organization was awarded a $100,000 grant from the Foot Locker Foundation Community Engagement Program to support its Each One of Us program. We talked to Helen Stagg, CEO of Change Happens, about the organization and what they do in the community.
Can you tell our listening audience what is Change Happens and what do you guys do for the community?
Change Happens is a nonprofit, community-based organization. We provide a whole list of holistic services, all designed to educate, empower, and provide to the needs of people in our community. We have a 31-year history of working here in Houston, in the Third Ward, as well as all of Harris County. And we're currently in 59 other counties across Texas as well, with some of our programs and services. We do everything from after school and summer enrichment programs to going into schools and other community settings to work with young people and youth for prevention of drugs, alcohol, tobacco, teen pregnancy. We work with youth who are incarcerated and transitioning back to the community to provide employment, education, training, mentoring, educational and employment opportunities. We have programs that work with housing for people who are homeless, working on issues of HIV to prevent and to treat. We have programs that work with people who are experiencing co-occurring mental and substance misuse disorders. We are also a federal navigator program working on issues of enrollment to health care through the Affordable Care Act. We focus on young girls who are involved in the justice system to provide case management and wraparound services and mentoring as well. And we are advocacy, advocating on issues of disproportionality regarding educational opportunities, youth involvement, particularly with minority young boys and girls in the justice system, and access to health care. So we have this whole holistic approach into the services that we provide.
And now you guys, I see you have the $100,000 grant that was given to you by Foot Locker, by the Foot Locker Foundation Community Engagement Program. Can you tell us about that and in the program itself?
Yes, we are indeed fortunate and grateful that we were selected by Foot Locker and Lyft for this really outstanding award. We have a mentoring program. It's called Each One of Us. We've been in mentoring for over 20 years. And this project, this particular project, works with young men of color attending Yates High School. Yates High School, as you know, might know, is a inner city school in the Third Ward area. And it was founded by Jack Yates, who was a former enslaved person. And so we have been providing mentoring, particularly at that school, for over 3 years now. We started with a grant through the Obama Foundation under the My Brother's Keeper program. We've expanded it to our Each One of Us mentoring programs, where we match a caring adult with a young man. And through that process, we know, and the research indicates, that young people who are engaged with mentors, a caring adult, someone to talk with, a friend, to support on an ongoing, regular basis, their academic achievements improve, their involvement in the justice system decreases, the risk of substance use and gang activity decreases as well. And this program will allow us, the funding from Foot Locker Lyft will allow us to expand the program and to reach 100 more additional young men attending Yates High School.
How can people find out about your organization?
Well, they can visit our website, which is changehappenstx.org. To find out more information, they can call us at 713-374-1200. We will have all today, with the announcement, we'll have all kinds of social media platforms that we'll be on, so they can check that out and find out a lot more. And we invite people to visit, to call, to learn more about the organization.
Yeah, and I guess you take people that want to mentor also from the community?
Yes, and, you know, that's one of the things. A mentor is requires a commitment of time. We expect them to make a commitment of at least 12 months and at least 4 hours a month to spend time with a young person. We know from evidence as well that you just can't come into a young person's life and be there for a week or two or a couple of months because it can have a more an unintended effect on that whole relationship. So we have to recruit mentors. And where do we recruit them from? From our community. We recruit from colleges and universities and university students, from civic organizations, from businesses, and that's anyone of course, we have a lot of mentees, a young men and young girls who want to be participate in the program, but sometimes the need, the demand does not match those people, potential mentors who are responding. So recruitment is an ongoing effort, and we would love for people to want to get involved and engage and serve in this really important role to serve as mentors for young people at risk.
I was going to ask, what's your relationship with the universities around the area, especially Texas Southern University and University of Houston and Rice?
Yes, they're all within this area. As you know, we're about walking distance from U of H and Texas Southern, and Rice is in close proximity as well. And we have a really good, long-standing relationship, not only with trying to recruit mentors from the student population, but serving as an institution here, Change Happens, to provide opportunities for interns and social work to come and work in the community. We work with various departments, including the UH Medical School and the Education Department and TSU's Evaluation Services. They provide staff and faculty to serve on our community advisory boards. We have relationships with evaluators from all of those universities, and they come in as external evaluators to look at our programs and to see, collect information and data and evidence that supports what we're doing and the effects and the outcomes that we're having. So we have longstanding relationships with all of them.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. I know you have 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, great. I'm glad to talk with you. And I just want to say that we're really thankful and grateful to Foot Locker List and for seeing the program that we have here and for realizing what the impact that it can have. And our deep connection to this community, they're awarding that grant helps. We really appreciate their understanding that and understanding how that helps in terms of expanding and growing the program. So we're really thankful for that.
That was Change Happens CEO Helen Stagg. You can find out more about the organization by going to changehappenstx.org. You're listening to The People's News on Community Radio KPFT Houston. Natalie Cochran met with Christian Panetta and Elizabeth Green from Lone Star Legal Aid to discuss what the public charge rule is in Texas and how it affects immigrants and their families, including their children, from accessing critical government services available to them.
The 2019 public charge rule created confusion and fear that may have prevented immigrants and their families, including their children, from accessing critical government services available to them. It is critical that immigrants and their families, many of whom are essential workers, are able to get access to necessary government services for which they may be eligible to keep their families safe and healthy. Elizabeth, what is the public charge rule?
Yeah, so the public charge rule is basically the law saying a person is a public charge who is primarily dependent on the government for support. So that's going to be, for example, cash-based assistance or income maintenance. It's going to be long-term care for medical care. So if you have some type of sickness that causes you to need long-term care at the government's expense, the government is going to determine, or they can determine, that you are a public charge, aren't primarily dependent upon the government to live your life, essentially.
Christian, where does the public charge rule stand now?
As of March 9, 2021, all green card applicants and petitioners to enter into the United States, they no longer have to provide information required solely for the public charge final rule, which means after the end of President Trump's office, the rules were reverted back to its original standing, and there are no longer any extra requirements or eligibility requirements for it.
And just to backdoor off that, that essentially means that applicants for adjustment of status or entry into the U.S. no longer need to file an I-944, which is also called the Declaration of Self-Sufficiency form, or provide any evidence related to that document, right? That would that those documents wouldn't play into the government deciding if someone is going to be able to adjust for status or had come into the United States or have entry into the United States, essentially.
What does the Connecting Texas Kids to Coverage Unit do at Lone Star Legal Aid?
The CKTC unit is dedicated on helping parents getting their children the medical coverage that they need by guiding them through the enrollment process. We both assist with CHIP and Medicaid applications, gathering the documentation, completing the actual application, and submitting it on behalf of the parents. Since both of these programs do offer low cost or free health insurance for kids and teens, depending on the program, it can go to children up to the age of 18 or 19. Also, both of these programs do offer benefits to eligible children, regardless of their parents' immigration status. So they solely look at the actual children and their eligibility, not the family as a whole.
Lone Star Legal Aid also can help qualified applicants apply for children's Medicaid or CHIP benefits. LSLA also applies on their behalf, monitors the progress of the application, and they'll notify you when a decision has been made.
Additionally, once the initial application is done, we also do provide the service of assisting families with to recertify their applications when it's time for the renewal. So we can help a family submit the initial application for obtaining those benefits. And then when the time comes for the children's benefits to be recertified, we go ahead and process that application for them. In some circumstances, LSLA does provide legal representation to these families when it comes to the appeal process. If their application is denied, their benefits are terminated, or there is some type of inaction in their case. LSLA is a free service, and that we will never be charged for any assistance that we do provide.
Thank you both for that information. If you or someone you know requires assistance obtaining medical benefits for your children, you can apply for free legal services by calling 1-800-733-8394 or by visiting our website at www.lonestarlegal.org.
That was Natalie Cochran, Kristen Panetta, and Elizabeth Green from Lone Star Legal Aid. You're listening to The People's News on Community Radio KPFT, Houston. Universities and colleges are slow taking up the conversation about what happened on January 6th. We hear more from the Texas News Service and Roz Brown.
Condemnation for last year's January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol emerged from all quarters, but some believe colleges and universities have been slow to respond in a meaningful way. Jeremy Suri, a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, says institutions may want to avoid controversy, despite a commitment to promote civic engagement and civil dialogue. He believes there's an obligation to teach students the event's significance, similar to what occurred after the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
It's not as if faculty aren't talking about it, but we're not talking about it publicly. We are individually, but the institution doesn't want to own it. They don't want to have an institutional teach-in as we should have had on January 6th.
Suri notes that the pandemic has been the biggest hindrance to a broader discussion, but adds that colleges and universities may not have pursued such events because the January 6th attack on the Capitol is viewed as a partisan matter that might upset donors and governing boards. Suri argues that teaching students about democracy, what constitutes fair elections, why elections matter, or how the country transfers power peacefully is nonpartisan.
It's our obligation to not just educate the students in the history and political science classes, the engineers should have access to this information too. And we fell down on the job.
Suri says the U.S. has had moments when its democracy was fuller and sought to include more viewpoints, and other times when deep divisions cause it to narrow, which he believes is happening now.
There's an assumption that many of us grew up with that American democracy was kind of a given. And what January 6th highlighted and reinforced, not just the flaws and difficulties of American democracy, but how precarious it is.
Suri advocates for colleges and universities to take on the civics challenge posed by the insurrection and hold teach-ins, symposia, and collective discussions. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks for listening to The People's News. The People's News airs every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. on KPFT's HD2 channel, and every Friday at 8 p.m. on our HD1 channel, also known as FM.
KPFT has been a staple in the Houston area and surrounding communities for over 50 years. With an amazing volunteer staff, we are able to produce exclusive programming that you cannot hear anywhere else. From every genre to the local current affairs programs, our volunteers give 100% to the communities in which we serve. As KPFT continues to evolve, we ask for your input and we ask that you support the arts, music, news, international news, and current affairs that you've come to know and love. With your support, we've been able to grow our programming and serve our communities more now than ever before. As time changes, isn't it good to know that you have a community station that does too? If you have not sent in your contribution to KPFT, now is a perfect time to do just that. Go online to kpft.org. Giving could never be easier. Thank you for your support of Houston's community station for over 50 years. 90.1.